Good morning and welcome to The Conversation on KMUN. My name's Graham Nystrom. Thrilled to be your host today. Good morning to you, friends on the radio. I'm really excited about today's show. Bringing in someone new to The Conversation. You might have heard this person on KMUN before, but I am very pleased to introduce Andrew Collins Anderson from the Coast Range Association. Welcome, Andrew Collins Anderson. Sorry, everybody, for the technical difficulties there. My apologies.
I'm sorry about that. Yeah.
No sweat.
what a rocky start. Hey, thank you so much, Graham, for having me.
It's all about context. So my concern here is that once we have a caller, I'm not absolutely convinced you're going to hear them.
Okay.
And so therein lies my concern. But let's start off by just getting you introduced. We'll hear a little bit about the Coast Range Association, and we'll maybe pitch some questions to callers, and we'll make this work one way or another. Thanks for your patience. So, thrilled to have you. How would you like to start? Tell us about the Coast Range Association.
Okay, great. Sorry, I wasn't sure. You introduced me already. I couldn't hear that if you did. My name is Andrew Collins Anderson, and apologies for the issue there. I work for the Coast Range Association, which is an organization that works on forestry issues here in the Coast Range of Oregon. The organization has been around for almost 30 years, working on public lands issues, other issues. And today, currently, we are more focusing on the climate crisis and how it relates to our region and how it relates to the forests of Oregon. We are very much involved in looking at the industrial forests of the Coast Range, the 4.4 million acres of large corporate-owned industrial forests that dominate Western Oregon. And in that work, we have recently developed a proposal that's a Green New Deal proposal addressing those lands, looking to transition industrial forest lands to social benefit and municipal public benefit, public utility ownership. It's a very interesting and broad proposal. It's brand new. We just put it out. You can find it at coastrange.org. And really excited to be here on the program talking about that, talking about the organization, and taking calls from listeners, asking all sorts of these questions about the forest in Western Oregon and in the Coast Range. We also, one of the main reasons we're here is that we have a program called Coast Range Radio that KMUN is very, very gracious in hosting the program on your station. We also are aired across Western Oregon on 11 community stations up and down the coast and in the valley. I'm the host of that program. And Coast Range Radio looks to bring experts, activists, passionate individuals in all sorts of areas to the radio waves to share their experience, share their success stories, share their knowledge on how we can work together to create a better world. I try to make the show be as broad as possible, bringing folks in from all ranges, scientists who are experts in conservation issues or climate issues, activists who are organizing people, folks who have been involved in forest issues in the Coast Range for decades. And it's been a really fun program, and lots of really great people that I've been able to meet and interview. We hope that folks and listeners have enjoyed that on your station. Tuesdays at 9 every other week. It's a biweekly program. And half an hour show. You can also find it as a podcast. And we had a couple of really exciting recent episodes, one that just aired yesterday with a woman named Sam Kropp, who is organizing to resist post-fire logging after the serious fires, the Labor Day fires, and what's happening on public lands to liquidate those burnt stands and how people can resist that. It's a very informative show. We also invited Sam on. Sam will be a regular contributor to the program, bringing a diversity of voices. She'll be doing interviews And which is really exciting. We're trying to expand the number of voices and viewpoints that come on the show, and really just see it as a, you know, a great tool to for folks to learn about what's happening here in Oregon with our natural resources and, you know, diverse and robust communities and how we can help improve them. Another episode that we recently aired that I was very honored to have Carol Van Strum on the program. She is a activist who's been resisting aerial herbicide spraying since the 1970s, and her work has been amazing in documenting the use of Agent Orange in the Coast Range on Forest Service lands back in the 70s. Her work was instrumental in her community's work was instrumental in ending some of that use and bringing to light some of the horrible atrocities that were perpetuated on the communities. Yeah, so it's just, we got some really exciting stuff. The Coast Range Association also works in marine issues. We're a part of a marine reserve partnership. Oregon Marine Reserves, there's five of them up and down the coast that are protected, state protection, and we're excited to be a part of that as well, working to protect our marine habitats and working with coastal partners. So lots of different interconnecting things. The Coast Range Association is a community organization, and we welcome folks to get involved. Learn more at our website, once again, coastrange.org.
Coast Range Association is a nonprofit.
Yeah, we're a nonprofit and have been a nonprofit since the early 90s. I didn't start working for the organization until a couple of years ago. Our director, Chuck Willer, is the founder and has been guiding the organization and prioritizing its work since its founding.
I hope I get to meet Chuck one of these days. That's really extraordinary that he could start an organization like this and stick with it for 30 years and continue to do all this great work.
Yeah, yeah. Totally. It's really exciting. And he's a inspirational person. He's been involved in this for a very long time. And, you know, it's funny, this is a kind of an anecdote, talking to Carol, who's been involved in this work since the mid-70s. Chuck has been involved for, you know, decades as well. Both of them, when I talk to them, interview them, they're like, you know, one thing that's really important to maintain and stay with this type of work for the long haul is humor and being able to, you know, take things in stride. You know, it's serious work. There's a lot of things that we're dealing with, you know, in an age right now, we're in a lot of crises, but being able to, you know, connect with people, build strength with networks and staying humble and having humor in these situations, I think is really important. So I always like to share that from their experience.
That's great. It looks like we have our first caller, so let's let them chime in. And I may have to relay the question to you, but let's try and see if we can make this work.
Great.
Good morning. You're on the air. Go ahead.
I want to know what the people at the things that they did for Washington are my coast. I am so sorry.
So was your question about what the organization does on the other side of the river in Washington?
No. I want to know what they do for Oregon's forest.
All right. So looking for some clarification on what the organization does. Let's get into some details about the kind of work you're involved in.
Yeah, totally. So
thank you to that last caller.
Yeah, thank you. I could hear that. So that's great. Yeah, so the organization over the years has been involved in forest planning. You know, Chuck was deeply involved in the Northwest Forest Plan as it was being developed. Today, we focus more, like I mentioned, on private industrial forestry. So we do a lot of research figuring out, you know, who owns these industrial lands. We actually have maps on our website that show, you know, the ownership in these different counties. You know, like I mentioned again, 4.4 million acres in Western Oregon are owned by these large private industrial timber companies. These companies a good portion of them are owned by investment-based firms that basically are managing these industrial forests for financial return. So very short rotation cycles, very efficient, basic agricultural management that has severe impacts both on ecological, water quality, these types of things, habitat, but also has severe impacts on rural communities' well-being. So forests, these timber companies have negotiated over the years to pay very little in taxes, income taxes. In Oregon, that used to go to counties. Counties have a very, these rural counties have a very hard time supporting public services. And basically, these companies are exporting their wealth out to the richest in the country and in the world, the richest 10% of people who own these and invest in these types of investment companies. So basically, what we do is we advocate for a change in that management structure to benefit forests and to benefit people, all right now very much focused on the climate crisis, because that is the overarching, we're dealing with many crises right now. We're dealing with economic crises, COVID-19, racial justice issues. All of these things are super important. And also, we are in the midst of a climate crisis, and Oregon's forests could play a fantastic role in sequestering carbon, bringing down the carbon from the atmosphere if these industrial forests were allowed to grow longer. So we advocate for solutions that would provide for that to happen.
Yeah, so I mentioned to you that I've been scrolling through the Coast Range Association's website. That's coastrange.org.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so on the about page, the vision statement, if I can read it to the folks listening,
please,
to build just and sustainable communities that provide for people and the natural world. And it goes on to say the Coast Range Association's work looks to address the underlying causes of social and environmental problems and seeks to instill common understanding, foster social unity, and provide practical solutions. We make every effort to speak directly to the connecting interests of people, communities, and long-term sustainability. And finally, Coast Range Association is a 501c3 nonprofit that has been working since 1991 to find just protections for Western Oregon's forests while supporting a vibrant rural economy. To see historic successes and past work, scroll to the bottom of this page where you'll meet the team, the board, the history of the organization. And that's just the about page. The next tab over is our work. So climate and Oregon's industrial forests, challenging Wall Street forestry, communities in the living ocean, Northwest Forest Plan. So I really encourage everyone that's listening to visit coastrange.org and learn more about this association and the work that they're doing. Tell me a little bit more, if you don't mind, about carbon sequestration and what is the growth or the life cycle of the forest, the forestry trees that are harvested versus, the ones that would be grown longer? What are the terms there?
Yeah. So there's some studies out of OSU, and a lot of studies about forest carbon. And, from what we've researched, the Pacific Northwest and Oregon's Western forest are some of the best in the world at storing carbon. So, wet forests, they grow, as we know, they're prized for their timber. They grow fast and they grow large. These trees in forests can grow huge. Native forests, these massive trees stored a large amount of carbon on the landscape over time. But in the transition to, timber production, these forests don't grow at the same. They're not grown like that anymore. We grow them more as an agricultural product. These companies will grow timber on short rotation cycles, around 40 years, that maximizes their investment. So, there's the process that happens on these industrial lands: clear cut, plant, spray, fertilize, and grow these a monoculture of trees that you'll hear from folks like OFRI, the Oregon Forest Resources Institute, or timber companies that they have more trees on the landscape, and that these young trees store more carbon because they're growing faster. But the case really is that's really not how it works. The large trees store a majority of the carbon on the landscape. And so basically we're advocating to increase that carbon storage with the realization that we are with the, you know, grounding that we are in a carbon climate emergency and we need urgent action. So by, you know, at the minimum, extending rotation cycles 80 to 100 years is what a lot of people bring up. You can store a lot more carbon on the landscape. You also could return some lost production. The current 40-year rotation cycle, you're actually not maximizing the amount of timber that could be produced on the landscape. You're just maximizing the return on investment when you're dealing with something like compound interest. So that's often what is used. You know, there's lots of different models, different companies use different rotation cycles, different management practices, but a lot of them are very similar in these short rotation cycles that don't store a lot of carbon when compared to native forests. There's also the issue of a carbon debt. We have liquidated the landscape of these old trees. A lot of that carbon has gone into the atmosphere over time. You know, only a portion, I don't have the exact percentage, but only a portion of a tree that's cut is actually stored in, say, timber that is in a house or into some sort of infrastructure that lasts a certain amount of time. A lot of that is lost. You know, the slash is burned, the excess in the milling process is all carbon that goes into the atmosphere eventually. So these large native forests are really a key part in addressing carbon storage and addressing the climate crisis. We've overshot, 350 parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere is often cited as, you know, a stable rate of a stable amount of carbon to avoid, you know, severe impacts to our climate. And we've overshot that at this point. And so we do need to have creative solutions to bring more carbon out of the atmosphere. And, you know, our forests are a piece to a larger puzzle. There's a lot that people are doing and need to do. And we just want the forest here in Western Oregon to be a contributing partner in that.
Well, I like the sound of solutions, and I just want to tell you how much I appreciate the work that you're doing. So thankful for smart people like you and hardworking people like you. I've got a question for you about fertilization, but we do have a caller, so let's try to squeeze that in. Good morning. You are on the air. What's your question today?
Yes, I have always been interested in the double standard that we exhibit here in the United States in regards to the cutting of forests in South American countries and the lack of control we exhibit over the cutting of our forests here. Your guest's last comment about carbon storage, I thought, revealed a lot. But I wonder if he might have some answers of what causes this double standard and how it could be fixed.
The double standard.
Paul, a little bit more about the double standard?
Well, we criticize a lot. I hear a lot about the rainforest in South America and the pressure we put on South American countries and governments about the cutting of rainforests.
So we're telling them they can't cut down the Amazon, but then we cut down
Gifford Pinchot. I wasn't clearer.
No, that's great. Thank you.
Yeah.
So maybe your guest can shed some light on why this double standard exists.
Yes,
what we could do.
I get where you're coming from. I think we need to hold ourselves accountable as well. I don't have a lot of knowledge or experience dealing with South American forests, and I, you know, we do talk about, you know, the Amazon being the lungs of the planet, and it's. Yes, I don't really have a strong answer for you there. I think
in our old growth and natural forests, and how that's being eliminated through clear cuts and plantation type practices. I wonder if you could shed some light on why this is continuing to go on, and what it might take to fix it. Is it just follow the money? Is that what it is, or is there some other reason?
Yeah, we look at that a lot at the Coast Range Association. We look at the money. And yes, like I mentioned before, the 4.4 million acres of industrial lands are about growing money. They don't grow trees or forests. They're growing those trees for a profit and money. So I think you're right in that sense. And solutions, the Coast Range Association. So when we're talking about these issues, it's very important to be clear about public lands and private lands. There's a lot of difference in how those lands are managed. There's a lot of difference in how to address and enact solutions to maintain, you know, vibrant, ecologically rich forests. Public lands, there's a huge amount of work being done by all sorts of great organizations trying to, you know, preserve the mature old forests that are on our public lands. Lots of great folks, you know, do ground truthing, are in, you know, our capitals, you know, working with legislature to ensure better protections for these forests, you know, really question when timber harvests do happen on public lands, BLM lands, Forest Service lands. There's a lot of work happening there. When it comes to private lands in Oregon, it's actually a lot different because our Forest Practices Act allows for a lot of, you know, allows for these clear cuts. You look at a map, you drive on the roads, you see these extensive clear cuts, and the rules, you know, there are rules for how they are allowed to do these harvests, but they're very minimal. They're actually some of the weakest rules in the West for our forests. And for these industrial privately owned forests. So the Coast Range Association tries hard to look at this really tough piece about the private lands. And we've often come down to the ownership issue that these lands are owned by these large corporate timber companies that are based on the growth of money. They're trying to make, they're working, and they do make profit at the expense of the forest and the expense of the rural communities. That is why we've been focusing so much on this Green New Deal proposal that I've talked about. This proposal is placing us in the current moment, climate emergency. A lot is going to happen in the next short time to address the emergency. Green New Deal is about, you know, changing the base energy infrastructure of our society. It's about bringing people up, providing opportunities for work, but social benefit for people, and opportunities for storing carbon on the landscape. We see the forest as these industrial lands as an untapped opportunity to build that carbon. And a Green New Deal investment in the emergency, the climate emergency, could offer up some solutions that are unimaginable at this point, or very on the edge of imagination. The transfer of ownership to social benefit enterprise, municipal companies, municipal public utility districts. You know, we have a lot of issues with timber companies owning forests in watersheds where communities get their drinking water from. And, you know, contaminating the water, creating huge expenses for our communities for treating that water. These communities don't have the resources to purchase these watersheds from these companies to protect the forest, to protect their drinking water. If we pass something like a Green New Deal to, you know, provide resources for these communities to be able to purchase those lands, we wouldn't have those water quality issues. We'd be storing carbon and protecting, you know, our essential water resources. So there's a lot of pieces to this that are really, you know, we need to think big, thinking about where we are in this current moment in time.
Graham, this is the caller again on the last question. When I was saying follow the money, is this an issue of political will? Is what's going on, if it affects local politicians and the money they can raise for whatever thing they want to do, like stay in office, is that the dividing line as far as us coming up with equal criticism of clear cut and deforestation, whether it be in South America or right here on the West Coast? Graham, you set my question right the last time, maybe. You can help me with that.
Yeah, no, I can answer. I get what you're saying. And, you know, there's a really informative piece. I think it came out in 2019. The Oregonian Rob Davis did a piece called Polluted by Money. And it showed that Oregon has some of the most, you know, lax rules when it comes to influence of money in politics. So we recently passed, I don't know the number of it, but there was a thing that was passed in 2020 for campaign finance changes. I don't know the exact name, but I think there's an opportunity there to kind of change the power dynamic of big industry in our politics.
That'd be wonderful. And I really appreciate all the programming you've been doing about forestry. There was one you did about Agent Orange being sprayed. I had a personal experience with that. A good friend of mine's daughter and wife were living down in the Oregon forest in the early 70s. They got sprayed. It just ruined this girl's health. I don't know if she survived, but it was a terrible experience, and many other people have suffered that. And I heard one commenter calling about that, one of your guests, and how little attention was paid to the physical damage to water supplies, but just downright health. Just people were being killed. And the timber company's attitude was, oh, well, at least way back then in the early 70s. Anyhow, that's the end of my comment. Greatly appreciate the program and your guest.
Thank you so much for bringing that up. Yeah, that interview I did with Carol was heartbreaking and really informative. I empathize with your experience. I had no idea what had happened here in the Coast Range with Agent Orange and what continues to happen. I understand more about the industrial herbicide sprays today. There's actually a film being played at digitally online at the Corvallis Theater called The People vs. Agent Orange, which goes deeply into that. It plays until this week. I think there's a chance for folks to check that out still, and it will air in the future as well. People should look at thepeopleversagentorange.com. We actually have a clip. I don't know, Graham. We have callers too.
We've got a couple callers, so let's talk to them. And then if we have let's play that Carol Van Strum clip. So next caller, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I wanted to ask about the rights of nature. In Pennsylvania, I think it was in 2006 maybe, part of the community got together, or activists got together, and pushed for legislation to declare a portion of their city or state to have its own rights. Corporations have our people, remember? So yeah. Why can't our forest lands have rights of nature? There is a movement, and those rights of nature can be challenged just in court, like you could sue me. Well, Columbia River confluence area could sue you, so that they would not have their own representation, but people could form groups could form to represent those ecosystems that were declared to have rights. Have you considered that kind of thing? Is that too futuristic or too hippie-ish?
Thanks for that great question. No, we partner with the community rights networks in Oregon who are working on those exact issues. There's community rights organizations throughout the state. There's Lincoln County, Lane County, a new one just started in Portland. There's a Douglas County, I believe. There's others too that I'm missing. Then there's the Oregon Community Rights Network, and they are working directly on these issues. Your listeners probably know about the aerial spray ban that happened in Lincoln County that is not active currently, but was active for 2 years, preventing aerial herbicide spray in Lincoln County. And that was pushed through by the Lincoln County Community Rights Organization. And part of that had a rights of nature component. So it's happening now. It's very inspiring. Carol Van Strum, again, the woman we interviewed, great activist, has been working on this for a long time, shares a lot of that information with us. And I think it has a piece in the puzzle for sure. And, you know, currently the Lincoln County aerial spray ban is in appeal. It was challenged by the industry and is not currently active. But, you know, that we can see what happens. If it gets repealed, you try again, try something else. I also know that the Oregon Community Rights Network is working on a constitutional amendment or some sort of amendment for the state to allow counties and local governments to pass stronger protections like an aerial spray ban. You know, they're getting turned down because of state preemption. So there's state laws that say you can't, you know, right to farm bills, these types of things that say these communities can't prevent aerial spray from happening. And so there's work happening on the state level to try to fix that so these communities can decide to protect themselves from these encroachment of their health and well-being.
Would you encourage, that sounds great, but would you encourage small, you know, like if you know of a tract of land and you feel that it's particularly important for the community, would you encourage people to form groups and try and activate some kind of rights of nature, or at least pursue all of the legislation first, all of the legislation governing that body of land, and then secondarily moving ahead to see if there can be some way of declaring rights of nature, or is that, it's just...
Yeah, I think you can do both. I'm always very supportive, and I think lots of folks are supportive of community organizing, coming together with your community, building power in that way. I think that's essential. So definitely connect with your community members, you know, connect, build that power, make, you know, do what you can to get the information, advocate for change. I don't think they're mutually exclusive. You can work on moving forward rights of nature and local legislation, state legislation. So yeah, I think it's all valuable, but definitely working together and building strong networks is going to be for the better.
Thank you very much for your work.
Thank you.
Thanks for that call. And we've got another person waiting patiently on hold. Thank you so much for your patience, but just wanted to chime in and say this is The Conversation on KMUN. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Andrew Collins Anderson from the Coast Range Association and about the work they do advocating for climate, local rural economies, forestry, watersheds, et cetera, et cetera. So let's see. We've got another caller. Good morning. You are on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning. I'm calling because I've been wondering about the aerial spraying of pesticides and herbicides, which desiccate the plants, and if often sprays are petroleum-based, and if they didn't exacerbate the fires that we had.
Do you know if those exacerbate fires, Andrew?
Oh, sorry. I missed that part.
Does the spraying exacerbate fires because they're petroleum-based?
I don't know that. I do know that, well, the fire issue is a big issue. There's a lot of pieces to that puzzle. And there is research and studies happening that show that the industrial timber plantations are more fire prone than an old growth forest, causing more danger, you know, more destruction when they do burn. And often these types of forests are the ones that are closest to our communities. So we look back to September and the Labor Day fires in the Cascades, and specifically the Holiday Farm fire. I know there's been some research. That fire that burned through there was through industrial timberland, burned super hot, and was a huge concern for the communities that were surrounding there, that fire. So you know, the Coast Range is a wet forest. It has there's a fire regime there, as in any forest. It's different than dry forests. So I don't have an exact answer to you, but yeah, fire is a huge piece. There's actually, we did an episode of Coast Range Radio with Tim Inglesby, who is a fire ecologist and a social ecologist who's excellent at the fire issue. And we talk about a lot of these issues. But I have yet to hear anything specifically regarding spray and fire.
Did I get some research on that and test the products that are being used and see if they are flammable? I can't help but think there's a connection between that.
Yeah, you know, in herbicides, they use the chemicals, you know, the herbicide themselves, but then there's also things like surfactants and other things that they put into the mixture to, you know, better affect the plants, these types of things. And so there's a lot of different chemicals in there that could be tested. Yeah, that's a good point.
Thank you.
Thank you for that call. Let's see. Why don't we go ahead and introduce that clip, Andrew?
Yeah, so I cut a clip out of one of our recent shows with Carol Van Strom. Like I said, she was a part of the work in activism against Agent Orange spray in the the Forest Service lands, Siusla National Forest. She was impacted by sprays when she first moved. Her family was to the area, Five Rivers. Alsea River area. So that's where she's based out of. And yeah, the clip goes over her initial experience of, you know, how she got involved in the work and how she, you know, what inspired that and what happened to her and her family.
All right, great. Let's hear this clip from Carol Van Strom, and then we will listen or hear from our next caller.
Carol, when I was reading your book, A Bitter Fog, and watching the film that you're recently featured in called The People vs. Agent Orange, I was deeply moved by you and your community's story and your standing up to the federal government and these powerful chemical companies like Monsanto and Dow Chemical. What happened to get you involved in this fight against herbicides, against these companies and the government's use of these herbicides, and how that led into your decades of troublemaking and writing these books?
Well, like most people, I started off totally naive about any of this until our children got sprayed by a county road crew when they were down by the river. The road runs right along the river. And shortly after that, the U.S. Forest Service sprayed the entire ridge almost surrounding our place. And when we found out that the ingredients that they were spraying were the same as Agent Orange, but at first we thought, oh, it's a mistake. They put the wrong thing in their tanks or something, and we just didn't believe that they would do this deliberately. But because my children got really sick, we had all poultry hatching with, you know, feet on backwards and crossed beaks, and our dog died. It was horrifying what happened. And when we looked at the river and saw what happened there, it was even more horrifying because there were dead fish floating all over. There were dead crayfish. There were dead ducklings, the merganser ducklings that we'd been watching. And scientist named Michael Newton wrote a glowing article about the use of these chemicals in forestry and what a revolutionary, wonderful thing they were. So they could clear cut and then spray the hell out of clear cut stripped land and replant it. And I kind of saw red, and I wrote a response to his article, which was published in our local newspaper and the News Times. And you have to realize we had just moved out here the year before. We didn't really know anybody, but very suddenly the people who live out here were coming to us and saying, hey, the same thing happened to us. We didn't know what was causing it, and told even more horror stories of horses losing all their hair and finding deformed deer in the forest. So the upshot was we got together with our neighbors and with some folks over the ridge in Deadwood and called the Forest Service to come in so we could present to them what was going on, figuring, well, that's how naive we were. We thought if we told them how bad this was for us and what was happening to us, of course they wouldn't do it anymore.
What year was that?
That was in 1976.
In 76.
Yeah. 75. Well, it was 75 and 76 because the articles happened in 75. And then what happened was, after several go-rounds with the Forest Service, we ended up finding a lawyer who would take our case and sue the federal government to make them stop. And that was the beginning of our our adventures.
So I'm curious, what were they actually using? What were these chemicals?
The chemicals they were using were a mixture of 50-50, pretty much, 2,4-D and 2,4-5-T, which was the same mixture they used in Vietnam.
That is intense stuff. Andrew, I figured out what my audio issues were, so I'm going to put on a minute of music and and change some stuff around and get back to you.
Great.
Give me the thumbs up if you can hear me. Very nice. Life can go on as normal from the engineering chair here. Thanks for tuning into the conversation. I'm Graham. My guest is Andrew Collins Anderson from the Coast Range Association, and we've got a caller who's been very patient. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. I have land in Jewell. I have about 100 acres and most of it in timber abutting Weyerhaeuser land. There's about 6,000 acres of Weyerhaeuser land out here, and a bunch of us have water that comes off it, and we were concerned because a couple of years ago they were going to dump 400 pounds per acre of fertilizer on Weyerhaeuser lands, and it comes out to over 2 million pounds, and it was a time when it was snowy like now in the Coast Range, and they didn't do it, because the helicopters, by the time they were ready, were already getting booked up for, I'm assuming, for all the spring spraying. So I was glad of that, but horrified that over 2 million pounds of fertilizer were going to be dumped, and in some places they do. But I gather they need to do it because the short rotations are just, the rain comes down all winter long on these herbicides, spray clear-cut soils that are just beating the hell out of these poor soils. And I also worry that the sedimentation is working its way down the Nehalem to Wheeler and Nehalem, because the silting in the river mouth of the Nehalem, the city of Nehalem had water in it, in the buildings from the backup of this last heavy rain, plus king tide. So, and I have a question for Andrew. When I look at the satellite pictures of all the clear cuts, I don't see many trees that look old enough to harvest. And how can this way of timber management that the industrial tree farms use, how can they really make that much money? And as contrast, the Oregon Department of Forestry has a whole different management plan of usually thinning 40-year-old stands and clear-cutting the 70-year-old stands. So that's my question, is when I look at all this extensive clear-cuts, how can the management really profit them, instead of letting the trees get older? And thank you.
Yeah, thank you. So you're right when you're that's very interesting to hear about your experience with the herbicide sprays, or I mean the fertilizer use. You know, these are basically agricultural lands. They're growing these trees like you would grow a cornfield. And so it takes a lot of inputs. you know, the young trees do grow very quickly, and they're basically, I'm not an expert on this. Chuck Wheeler, our director, has studied this for years, the economics of forestry. And you can reach out to us. I can be reached at andrew@coastrange.org. We can get you more information. But the short of it is that, you know, they're growing these trees as an investment, trying to meet a compound interest. So what they're, you know, there's the opportunity cost of growing trees longer when they could be investing money in, you know, some other investment that has a growth rate, you know, I don't have the number right off the top of my head, but a certain amount of growth rate in the money, they're banking that these forests will meet that. Otherwise they're imagining that they're losing money when they don't meet that, that compound interest, using that compound interest, meeting that growth rate. So when the trees reach that a certain age, you know, the 40 year mark around, you know, it's different for every all stands and circumstances, but around that area, that's when the tree growth isn't meeting that rate, and they cut the stand and start over. And so, you know, you're getting a lower quality timber. You're not getting as much, there's a loss production, loss of the amount of timber. You're not in. So, but that's not the purpose. The purpose is the most efficient growth of money.
So, unfortunately, only 10 minutes left in the show, and I feel like we could keep talking for another hour at least, but yeah. I sort of have a similar question to Susanna about fertilizer and about growing a forest like a cornfield.
Yeah.
You know, I've heard that soy really leaches the soil to grow soy. It's hard to replenish the soil after you've, you know, monocultured soy. What's the deal with our forests? You know, it's got to take a lot of energy in the ground, a lot of, like, I can't remember what you said, material or resource or
inputs.
You know, so say it all stops tomorrow, is the soil gonna be able to sustain the future of the forests?
Yeah, it's a big question. And I'm not a soil scientist. I don't know the specifics. There are studies that go into that. And, you know, it's evident that they do use fertilizer, that, you know, the soil is, you know, reaching its limit. It's been extracted so much that you need to put inputs, fertilizer inputs, to continue, you know, their desired, you know, targets, growth targets. So, I can't answer that, you know.
Well, this show is all about asking questions, you know.
Yeah, no, it's good. And, it's good. And it is, we do know that they're being, you know, overused. The soils are damaged. There's huge issues with erosion when you do clear cuts. You know, you're opening up that land, so you're losing topsoil in that way. So, it's a big question that needs to be addressed. And kind of go back to the initial part of the caller's question about worrying about Wheeler. There's some really excellent groups. There's the, I have it right here, the North Coast Community for Watershed Protection, that works directly on addressing, you know, in the current moment, forest clear cutting, aerial herbicide spray issues. There's also tonight, there's a training. So folks who want to get involved and learn more about how to, you know, connect with specific groups, how to challenge these industrial practices, these huge owners. There's a group that's putting together a webinar that's happening tonight at 5 p.m. You can go on to Facebook, and there's several organizations that are hosting the event. If you search them, Oregon Wild, Cascadia Wildlands, Kalmiopsis, Audubon Society, and Rogue River Keeper, if you go onto Facebook, look for them, look at their events, you'll find this event on their pages, and you can sign up for tonight and join the webinar to learn more about, you know, the ferns, the herbicide and timber sale tracking system that the state has, learn about organizations in your area that you can work with, tools and techniques for how to challenge these projects, strategies for engaging your decision makers, and all coming together as community. So I just wanted to offer that opportunity for folks who want to get more involved.
Great. And pointing back to your website, coastrange.org, there is something right at the top of the page called Climate and Oregon's Industrial Forests, a Green New Deal Proposal. There's one of your Coast Range Radio episodes, interview with Chuck Willer down at the bottom about the Green New Deal and Oregon's industrial forests. Do you want to talk a little bit about that report or that proposal?
Yeah, thank you. I kind of opened with it, but didn't get into the details. So this is something that we released just a couple weeks ago, Climate in Oregon's Industrial Forests, a Green New Deal proposal. You can go to our website, coastrange.org. You can read the executive summary, learn more, read the full proposal. It's a 50-page or almost 60-page document that basically outlines the current situation that we're in with the climate crisis. We are in an emergency. We need to act immediately. It outlines how the timber industry is hurting our communities, hurting our forests, and specifically how. So some of the questions about, you know, the growth of money, all that is answered in that document. We have an extensive section all about the timber industry's practices and economics and impacts to workers and communities. And we go into issues with contracted timber workforce. We go into issues with the often immigrant reforestation, plantation workforce. And then we offer solutions to this issue based in the climate crisis. Land reform, funded through a federal Green New Deal, money to go to local communities, municipalities, cooperative social benefit enterprises to purchase these lands, grow carbon dense and economically and a rural community benefiting forests. So the pitch that we give is, you know, we have two of three options here as we see it. We can have robust, ecologically rich, old, large carbon storing forests. We can have vibrant, prosperous rural communities, or we can have the export of industrial profits to the richest 10%. You can pick two of those three. We know the two that we pick. Pretty straightforward, and when you put it down to those simple terms.
So the thing that appeals to me the most about this is the point that the impact is for social benefit, and that would include folks who are currently working in the timber industry, right?
Yeah, definitely. So we try to speak to those issues, and we try to. We're not saying, you know, nationalize the forests, these private forests. We're not saying, you know, no timber harvest. You know, we're grounded in the fact that we will need some timber products. And there's a way that we can do this. You know, we base the solutions, this social benefit cooperative model off of New Deal era, you know, electric co-ops, communications, telephone cooperatives that still to this day provide excellent services to rural communities. They're a model that folks in rural areas that, you know, participate in and appreciate that could be used in the forest sector and would benefit our communities, benefit people's, improve people's lives. You know, and this also is all brought into a Green New Deal framework where, you know, we're going to be changing our energy infrastructure, transportation infrastructure, housing, all these things. And this is a piece to that puzzle that will benefit rural communities. And it fits right into the Green New Deal. The Green New Deal has a section about deindustrialized rural communities. We're not leaving anyone out.
I want to recall, I think it was Gwen's comment about can nature have rights, or can forests have rights, or can watersheds have rights? And how do you get involved? What kind of a group do you put together? And I think that what this makes me think of is, isn't it nice to figure out what's already got momentum, what already has work and effort behind it that is going in this direction, and figure out how we can jump on that bandwagon, which is exactly what you're doing. You know, the Green New Deal is sort of this, I mean, I don't know what you would call it, whether it's idea stage or it's a hopeful future, you know, but it's people trying to find solutions to problems. And then the work you're doing, dovetailing in with the Green New Deal, you know, you've found this thing that already has some work and some momentum put into it. And I applaud you for it. And I think that might be a good way for people to approach this if they do want to get involved, is look for those organizations like the Northwest Council for Watershed Protection.
Thank you for that. Yeah. Thank you for that, Graham. And, you know, the Green New Deal is a call for proposals to address the climate crisis while providing for people, you know, whatever Biden passes, whatever the current administration passes, we're there. It doesn't have to be called the Green New Deal. we're there advocating for our forests and our communities. We'll make that happen. Folks want to get connected, coastrange.org. You can reach me at andrew@coastrange.org. Send me an email. We'll have more shows about this with Coast Range Radio. Thank you so much, Graham. Really appreciate being on your show and being able to have our program to help spread the word about this.
Absolutely. We would love to have you back sometime and keep making the great radio that you are making. Remind the folks out there what time your show airs.
It's Tuesdays, 9 a.m. Biweekly. It's the second and fourth Tuesday, 9 a.m. And it's a half an hour show. And we're actually, our next episode, we're interviewing woman Allie Rosenblum. Bluth, I forget how to pronounce her last name, but she is active with Rogue Climate about the LNG pipeline in Coos County and the recent successes there.
Andrew Collins Anderson, thank you.